In the first session, we looked at DNA understood as what was being planted. And now in the second section, I want to take DNA in another sense and try to tease out more, well, how does it happen? What are the processes? What are the mechanisms of creating or planting churches? I have to say, this does come with some health warnings. Recently on the internet, there were some simple home remedies that were publicized that I found quite interesting. I don't know if you've ever tried this one. If you're choking on an ice cube, don't panic. Simply pour a cup of boiling water down your throat, and hey presto, the blockage will almost instantly be removed. And if, of course, you favour a more collegiate way of doing things, there's this one. Are you clumsy? Well, avoid cutting yourself while slicing vegetables by getting someone else to hold them while you chop them. And one that I've actually found terribly, terribly helpful, really, in adjusting to the time changes my body is going through. It says this: if you put a mouse trap on top of your alarm clock, this will prevent you from rolling over and going back to sleep after you hit the snooze button. And I don't know whether this one will translate to the Canadian context. Do you have WD-40?
Yes.
And you have duct tape? Well, this is very important then, really, for anyone who's a church planter, or perhaps actually a diocesan bishop. If it doesn't move and it should, use the WD-40. And if it shouldn't move and it does, use the duct tape. So, very nice. Well, so you'll appreciate, I have just a little bit of about going into this kind of how-to stuff, but Connie's helped make me a bit bolder, so here we go. I think the first comment I just want to make by way of almost a preface to this is to say we've actually almost stopped in England using the noun a church plant for a couple of reasons. One is that we have found there are simply so many kinds of churches that could be planted, or in Connie's helpful phrase, the biodiversity of it, that the language of a church plant, in some ways, is a bit unhelpfully restrictive, unless we're very clear we're speaking generically. And secondly, our experience has been in England that too many of our so-called church plants have been unhelpfully similar to the parent body that sent them, and therefore not well enough adapted to their mission context. And as such, you could even question whether they really were planted. In effect, they were actually transplanted. So part of that has led us to trying out this phrase, creating fresh expressions of church. However, I do want to say, and Stuart Murray, my colleague, some of you may know, informal colleague in England, we both still think that the verb church planting is extremely valuable. And it describes a process. I've simply put that on the screen. And perhaps the first session looking at the DNA of church and insisting that language of church and plant needs to be held together, the ecclesial and the missional, partly explores why. So what then might be the relationship between church planting and fresh expressions? One take, not the only one, might be this. Church planting is in effect the discipline. If you like, it's a new branch of practical theology. And fresh expressions then should be the fruit of that discipline. So it then becomes meaningful to talk about planting fresh expressions of church, or FXC, and welcome to death by acronym. So this, I think, connects then with the first point I'd like to try to make about DNA understood as how planting fresh expressions happens. And if you like, there are a couple of how-to principles, or if you like, to use an analogy, they're like a couple of fairly important tools that you might use if you were a carpenter in order to make something. But of course, the point of being a carpenter is to make something for which you need the tools. The tools themselves are just instruments to a greater end. And these are the kind of things I want to try to tease out with you this afternoon. So here's the first of those, let's call them processes, but you might also call them tools. And it is actually to think that seeds are a very key idea. because going from existing church in apostolic mode, we take with us seeds. Seeds of both the gospel and the church, as I suggested to you in the first session. Now, these seeds then get taken out and planted as the missionary journey unfolds. Now, please note this. These seeds must be allowed to die to take root in the context to which we are sent. Here, then, is the essential principle. Seeds must be allowed to die. And the report, Mission Shaped Church, which has been alluded to, talks about this both in the pragmatic bits of its third chapter on what we've learned from 15 or 20 years of church planting in England, and its chapter on theology. I want to root this principle theologically because I'd like to try to offer you a rationale for saying, actually, this is biblical sense. And this instinct, I suggest to you, is rooted, not least in Jesus' words, in John 12. And they suggest that dying to live is absolutely inherent in the Christian way. This is not just some weird game that those planting fresh expressions of church play. After all, baptism should have reminded us of it. It is a symbolic enactment of and identification with the death and the resurrection of Christ. Now, just in case we're in doubt, I believe he made it entirely clear that his patterns are to be our patterns. So, in the passage in John 12, where he speaks of himself as a seed that will die, he goes on and says this: if anyone serves me, he must follow me. So, where I am, there will my servant be also. Now, I find it both curious, an observer, and worrying as a person called to love the church and to long for the growth of the kingdom, that while we have taken the notion of death and resurrection into some liturgical rites, such as baptism, we link it to parts of the church's year. So Christians ritually, you know, die to chocolate once a year in Lent or something like that. We embrace it quite rightly in some patterns of spirituality, but broadly, we have omitted taking it into mission. And yet, the very person who taught mission to us said this was the pattern of his mission. And Jesus made it, I think, very clear. His followers are to be committed to his patterns. So I invite you, as it were, to flick on in the pages of John's Gospel, and now I'm going to John chapter 20. And it's this same Jesus who is bringing peace among his startled disciples in the first of these post-resurrection experiences. And he shows to them his hand and his side. And if you want a small rerun, you can ask John Bowen to lift up the front of his T-shirt. Sorry, John. For a small fee. Quite clearly, in such an action with his hand and his side, the cost of this is not glossed over. That's entirely clear. But then some missionary headlines follow. Or if you want that translated into ecclesiological language, at this point, apostolic identity is conferred upon the church. And what Jesus does is he says this: as the Father has sent me, so I send you. I'd like to suggest to you that this little word "as" could actually do quite a lot of work. As the Father sent me, in the same manner as I was sent as God's apostle, so I'm sending you. As, on the same journey from an incarnational identification with culture to a disclosure of lordship, endorsing countercultural engagement, so I send you. As, in the same way that I, the seed, died in the ground, and by the way, you saw it last Friday, hear him saying, and now have emerged, both similar, so you recognize me, and different, I'm going to come and go, so I send you. As I, in the way that would be described by Paul in Philippians 2, the eternal Son was willing to die to the glories of heaven and to be transformed into the likeness of a dying slave. So, I send you. And as in the same way of becoming very different, to become like those to whom I was sent, so I send you. Quite a lot of stuff going on in one little word, as. But perhaps my main point here is this. Have no doubt that the patterns of Jesus are for us all. They are for the whole church, most especially as it becomes clearer that the church is extension of the mission of Jesus. Those patterns then apply in the creation of fresh expressions of church. They apply in all cross-cultural work. Dying to live is entirely normal because it is the norm set by Christ. So then we come to Jesus' teaching on dying to live as normative for the church. In John 12, he shows us he saw his own life and ministry as a seed that would die. And only by this could new life come, as he was raised by the Father, and this would lead to the creating of much fruit. And it's a pleasure to me to see the apples and the oranges and the grapefruit and the bananas here this afternoon. Sorry about the bananas. Let's move this then from theology, where it must have its roots, to simply our practical experience. We know that if you want to grow a plant, not transplant one, if you want to grow one, you've got to sow a seed. Seeds, however nice they are, however pretty or interesting or fascinating, in an unopened packet, simply cannot be described as planted. You have to take them out of the packet. What then happens is an agricultural funeral. They are buried in the soil. They are interred, if you want to go Latin. It means an intentional end to their existence, unless the neighbour's cat calls, in which case you simply got to do the thing again. The whole point is that you do not see them again. And then something really weird happens. Something related to the seed but different from it starts up, grows up out of the ground. Now, they knew that in the first century. Paul knew this factor of similarity and difference. He teaches it in 1 Corinthians 15 in relation to death and eternal life. Well, again, let's continue to try to be practical. Let's translate that into the dynamic in the church planting process in any mission context. The seed stands for the incoming church planting team, who bear in their bones this essence of gospel and of church. What then has to happen? The seed needs to die to its previous identity in some sense. You see, these people were part of a particular sending church. It had its own particular manifestations and culture, and they have to be willing to set aside those preferences and likes to find out how to be church, how to communicate gospel in the context to which God sends them. I want to say to you, this is not new. This is like Paul saying in 1 Corinthians 9, to the Greeks, I became as a Greek. Now, most of us today go, well, that's all right, I can do garlic. If I said to you, to the pagans, you must become as a pagan. To the consumers, you must become as a consumer. You might be more suitably shocked. And then we'd be actually getting to what Paul is saying. And so, this seed will become a body, a plant, that it was not before. Plant and seed are related but different, as 1 Corinthians 15 teaches us. So dying to live is inherent in this church planting discipline and process. Let me translate that again. The planting team by mixing with its mission context, becomes rooted in it. It actually draws part of its nourishment and resources from that environment. It sends out roots into that environment, and then, very slowly, a shoot emerges. And by that process, it actually dies as a seed, changing from what it was. So let me put it to you this way. In church planting, the seed community becomes a new body of believers, not just a body of new believers. And as such, this planting analogy has got some real strengths. It conveys, by analogy, what should occur theologically in all mission, and that's especially obvious when it is cross-cultural, which I suggest to you is likely to be the majority of our future. Now, there are, however, because I'm English and you expect me to go "ah, but" at some point, there are some dangers I want to suggest to you in this planting way of thinking. One comes from a view of what is planted. You need to take on board that this language of seeds, though biblical and endorsed by Christ, is just a helpful analogy. The reality of what's being planted is a Jesus-centered community and mission who are entering another area or culture in order to be gospel and create church that relates to that area of culture. And this is certainly not a mechanical process that can be totally controlled like a production line. And at that point, it was great. Connie and I are clearly singing from the same hymn sheet about this. And some church planting teaching that you can read in other places feels a bit like that. Do the following 17 steps and, you know, out of the concrete mixer will come church. I'm very sorry, but it's organic and messy and uncertain. It's just not like that. It isn't even, I want to say to you, biological. And it's a bit cavalier to say, well, it doesn't matter if a few dozen seeds die because you get enough vegetables in the end from the ones that live. I'm not sure that's going to do. Because what is this process? It's both human and spiritual. Maybe it needs the kind of love, intention, care, thought, skill, and make it up as you go along, that we apply to human reproduction all the way through from pregnancy to birth and on into the life cycle. Oh yes, willingness to die to my preferences about how to do church, so that others in the receiving culture may be found by Jesus and a fresh expression suited to them comes to life, that's honourable, that's essential. But being mechanistic about the process or cavalier about the costs is quite another matter. Well, here's another skill that we're learning in the process about, well, if dying to live is right, how do you decide in that process what do you keep and what do you change, or what do you allow to change? And I want to say there's another kind of tool that you need to use alongside dying to live thinking. And in Mission Shaped Church, it's what we called double listening, clearly related to the seeds dying principle. To reach people different from us, those of us sent have to die to our preferences about how to do church, so then question, what is the essence of what must be kept? Very like asking, what is the DNA of gospel and church within the dying seed that will then grow into the roots and emerge in the shoot and eventually flower, and people go, oh, that's church. We've just never seen one quite like it, but obviously it is. And we looked at some of the content of that last night. This process, then, of finding out involves, I think, two things. Both of them are attending to what God is saying. Double listening means entering and understanding a culture into which church might be planted, created. truly with one ear listening to the mission context. I suggest to you a paradigm example of that is Paul wandering around Athens in chapter 17 of Acts going, what's going on here? He's doing that ear of the listening. Now, the other ear means sifting the inherited tradition of both gospel and church and seeking to find something more like its essence, not its forms. Again, I believe we see this on the pages of the New Testament. That is what Paul is doing when he rejects circumcision as necessary for new Greek Christian believers. You can imagine the scene. He's with some Greek guys and he says, guys, I've got good news for you. It comes in two parts. One is Jesus, and the second is we don't have to do circumcision. You decide which is better. Well, that's a slight gloss on the text. But those are the two directions of what is going on. Those are the two sources of what's going on, and both are there in the missiological pages of the New Testament. So then, yes, I admit, it's a bit complex. However, you then get a richer, more accurate sound. It's better for discovering what an expression of church may look like. Now, we've found in England, as we try to explain double listening to people, sometimes people misunderstand. And one of the misunderstandings is this. They misunderstand what we're saying about the sources. So here's an example from, it ought to be true, wouldn't it? It comes from the Church of England's Board of Readers website. You know, nearly Vatican, close. And what they've put there, double listening is the faculty of listening to two voices at the same time. So probably can only be done by women. And the way they put it on the website is the voice of God through Scripture and the voices of men and women around us. This builds on the John Stott view in one of his books from 1995 that we listen to God's Word and God's world. Now, I agree, both belong to God. I agree that the Word has a higher authority for us in determining what we believe and do. However, I find that view narrow in two ways. Let me explain. I think it too much separates out the Word from the listening that comes by knowing the living tradition, which has grown out of the Word, helps us be more humble and flexible in returning to the Word, but never has higher authority than the Word. It also, I think, is in danger of separating out listening to the Word from listening to the Holy Spirit, who will be active in the world and in the particular culture to which any particular apostolic person is sent. And there will be the factor that God as creator, as you see in Romans 1, has left some fingerprints of what he's doing within any particular culture. So the classic New Testament examples of this process of listening to God through the world might be Peter, learning in the Cornelius story, or Paul, again, learning from his Athens visit. So double listening as we meant it when we wrote the short bit about it in Mission Shaped Church is seriously saying the voice of God is being sought with both ears. The ear that listens to the living tradition, the ear that listens to the culture to which a person is sent. So how does that work in practice? Well, let's again be aware of some of the dangers if we stray off the sort of windy path that this involves. For the planting of churches, listening both to contemporary culture and church tradition are vital. If you listen only to the culture, that's going to be the result. You will end up with syncretism, in which either gospel or church or both are perverted and distorted by the culture. Now, it's a very interesting question. Is Christendom itself guilty of such a mistake? Arguably, that could be true. However, if you only listen to the inherited tradition and you remain theologically absolutely squeaky clean, the life and the message of Jesus is not likely to engage with that culture, and it will be disconnected and irrelevant, therefore nothing is gained. So this is a difficult business, and you can fall off, as it were, on either side of holding these two things together. Now, a mission, of course, it's not true that we come with completely empty hands, hearts, or brains, at least hopefully. The key thing is to have open ears. And in that sense, perhaps there's an order in this double listening process. We do bring what we ourselves have inherited, but somehow almost you have to suspend that to pay attention and listen first to the mission context, to culture, and to the world. And that comes before discerning how the inherited Christian tradition works with that culture. So mission precedes the shaping of the resultant church when the seed of the gospel in the church roots in the mission culture. Now, some of you may then be thinking, oh, I see what you mean. When it comes to evangelism, that's about listening to the culture so we know how to do Jesus in groovy ways that people will get. And when we're church, we listen to tradition so that the bishop is going to be happy or something like that. I would want to say to you that is a disastrous combination and not at all what I meant. Using a farming metaphor, that's the way in which, all right, some fruit of evangelism might well be gained, but what will happen is it will be left to rot in the fields because the barn of the church is simply no good to store that kind of grain. So I want to say, no, don't let's do that. Changing the metaphor, though still saying biological, was it not someone called Jesus who said, if you've got some new wine, I have a little bit of advice. You might like to start looking for some new skins. We work then at double listening over both church and gospel. And so it's not surprising, creating fresh expressions of church is two listenings over two tasks. And that little icon on the screen, which is kind of cross with circle, for me is icon for saying Jesus-centered community. That's all I'm saying. Nothing difficult about that. Well, let's go back then to this order and do a little bit more work. This order of double listening and the different dynamics as the discernment in the process unfolds. Listening to the cultural context comes first, and it shapes the gospel-bearing church that emerges. That's actually partly what we meant when we said mission-shaped church. We actually meant it in that order. Now then, something important also happens. The second ear of double listening, hearing the inheritance of faith, uniquely revealed in the scriptures, what does that do? That validates and assesses the expression of gospel and church that is emerging. And even then, it's sometimes possible that those in the context may actually challenge how we, the incoming outsiders, have understood word, and they may be right. Examples of this are found in the classic mission book, Christianity Rediscovered. And at certain points, Vincent Donovan found the Maasai understood better than he did, and he was a highly trained Jesuit missionary. Whoa. So, double listening, a process which enables something to evolve as its context changes. And it holds in tension these two things: creative engagement with context and faithfulness to the good news in Jesus. It is not easy. It is not simple. It is not quick. All I'm saying is it's essential and it's creative. And it's very like the order that we see, if you like, in Jesus' own ministry. Firstly comes incarnation into culture. Secondly comes countercultural engagement with that culture. Let's have another DVD clip and see how some people working such a process came up with a way of doing church, which has certain features of novelty about it.
Hi, my name's Sam. Why don't you come and see my church?
And in fact, Sam's church is a youth congregation based in a skate park called Legacy XS in Benfleet.
The youth congregation started in about 2001, and it was about 6-9 months later when we went to Soul Survivor and we saw them doing their first lift venue, which was their skate park. And combined that with the idea that we got of wanting a drop-in sort of area, like a pavement cafe, that kind of thing. And that's really, those two ideas came together, and that's how the idea for Legacy XS, this place we're sitting in now, was born. And really, the vision for that has grown alongside the youth congregation itself. We didn't initially intend to build something quite this big, so the project kind of grew matched our faith, if you like. And I guess if you'd said to us when we first started, oh, you're going to need £500,000 to do it, we might have thought, we won't ever be able to raise that. But when the first numbers were bandied around, we thought, yeah, that's doable. We'll write to charities, we'll approach members of the congregation, etc., etc. So gradually, sort of as the numbers increased, so the amount of funding that we needed increased. But God honoured that and matched what we needed. The way in which people tend to get involved in the youth congregation these days is mainly by friendship evangelism. They will come along, they'll be skating together or riding together with their Christian friends, and then one evening they'll suddenly decide to stick around and come along to something that's a little bit, you know, more involved in the spiritual side of things. But because of the nature of what we do in our worship, and we do try to include the use of the ramps, using the skateboards, using the BMXs, and allowing them to express themselves in worship using those things, that's, you know, it's quite a natural transition for them. And very quickly and very soon they find themselves becoming sort of involved.
I was quite nervous when I came down here because I didn't know no one down here. I didn't have no friends. When I first joined up, I was on my own. And I come to the Sunday services that they do on a Sunday night, and I quite got into it, and I answered the questions about Jesus, and I brought Jesus into my life, and I really liked it, and I really wanted to become a Christian. And I spoke to Pete about getting baptised, and it was all sorted out, and I became a Christian. I'm glad I did it.
The analogy I would use when we are encouraging young people to use skateboards or BMXs or inline skates to worship would be, for example, liturgical dance. What we're talking about is someone using their sport, using something they enjoy, using their bodies, something they're very comfortable with using, and then focusing that towards God, either in the form of prayer or as an act of worship, and saying, instead of landing this trick for the pleasure of doing it for me, I'm going to land it for the pleasure of you. I've had a 6'3", 17-year-old lad with tears rolling down his face saying to me, I didn't realise that my love for Jesus and my love for skating could come together and be used together. I've seen young people rising to the challenge of tackling a particularly difficult trick, or dropping in on a quite a high ramp that they're quite scared about, and we've stood there and really sort of prayed for them while they've plucked up the courage to do it, and seen them overcome something that they were scared of, they were afraid of. That's exciting in itself.
There's a big feel of being led by God through the whole project and through congregation. I mean, it's very God-based. The congregation is so strong. It's being part of a community.
Before I came to know Legacy, I was an atheist, and a friend of mine asked me if I just want to come along to a youth club one evening, so I said it'd be fine, and it didn't really say there was anything faith or religious to do with it. And I came along, and I just encountered this group of people who were just like normal. It's a drummer to look quiet. But the things they were talking about, things to do really deep inside, things to do with their faith, and things to do with God and to do with Jesus. And eventually, after a while, I became a Christian, and I've been coming since then. As I learned more about Jesus, as I learned more about being a Christian from the people who were leading it, they weren't really like the adults. They had something to do with it as well. But the people of our age, the teenagers and the young adults, they're the ones who will get up and preach the sermons, they're the ones who will get up and play in the worship bands.
The analogy I would use is the way in which when St Paul, for example, is going around planting churches in the New Testament, the Holy Spirit creates new churches, gives birth to new churches in every different cultural context in which Paul finds himself. And in a sense, the Holy Spirit is still doing that today, in particular cultural contexts, and that's really where the sort of youth congregation fits. It's nothing to do with age, actually. It's to do with cultural difference and cultural gaps. I would want to encourage anybody who has even the slightest inkling that they might be called to do something to just act. Don't worry about what it might or might not look like or it might or might not become. Just do something. Now, that sounds a bit irresponsible sometimes, but I kind of suspect that the Holy Spirit's a bit irresponsible like that. He calls us into some really big, crazy things that if he gave us the whole picture, we'd run a mile. And to be honest, if he told us what it was going to look like when we first came up with this idea, or we caught on to what he was saying, we'd have run a mile. We'd never have done it.
So there you have dying to live, willing to put down our preferences so that what God is actually wanting in a particular context can emerge. And double listening is a process by which some of that, at least you have a framework for doing some of the negotiating of that. Here's a third kind of tip that we've found quite helpful. I suppose it's a fairly... I mean, do you know the thing? Sometimes the right questions are easier to identify than knowing what the answers to those questions are, and it's a bit like this. Mission Shaped Church wanted again to suggest to us that asking the right questions and in the right order is helpful. If it's true that mission shapes church, then it follows, it makes sense to ask first, who is a fresh expression for, before you're going to ask the question, how are we going to fund it, staff it? How will it relate to the wider church? So Mission Shaped Church put it in this way. Start with the church, and the mission will probably get lost. Start with the mission, and it's likely the church will be found. Now that's a pragmatic, not a theological statement. Fair enough. Now in the language that Mission Shaped Church has adopted, to make fresh starts that are thought through, perhaps it's helpful that an expression of church should be formed by three considerations, three dimensions taken in a particular order. And you can see in that cube up there that the who for question is one dimension, who with is another, who by is yet another. And clearly you can't answer the one question simply by asking the other one. So if I just remove the diagram for a moment and get the order right, we're suggesting it's like this. This is the first question. What's the mission goal? Who is this fresh expression for? Is it network? Is it neighborhood? Is it de-church people? Is it non-church people? Because the way things will work may be very different depending on how you answer that question. Only secondly, do you then come to the second question? What's the resource? Should this be something pioneering, responding to a weakness that we perceive currently is there? Should it be progression? Does this build on a strength we already have? Is it going to be done in a small church model like cell or a larger church model like congregation? Those are all resource questions, but don't start with that. Ask who it's for first. And then comes the question of, who might be the partners in the wider church with us, and the four models that we happen to know in England of partnership, runners, grafts, seeds and transplants. Now is not the time to go into the differences of those dynamics. You could read all of that up in chapter 6 of Mission Shaped Church. What's really important is the principle of the right questions in the right order. So as we were doing that research, it was really interesting to us to come across the example of the Church of the Saviour, Washington, D.C., that some of you may know. They've created an enormous range of congregations, each around a specific mission context. These are their three questions, quite similar to ours. I think they've got their questions in the right order. What's the mission to this area? Second question, so what kind of community is needed to sustain that kind of mission? And third, really important question, what's the sort of spiritual disciplines that will be required to sustain the community in its mission? Very, very similar. I want to end with a fourth thing that goes a bit beyond mission-shaped church, though there are perhaps some hints in it. And the fourth kind of tip about this is, don't assume that starting with worship is the best way to do it. If we realize that mission shapes church, and this creates a go shape, not a come shape, that questions whether provision of worship is the most obvious starting point in mission and church planting. Let me first go back in order to take you forwards. I want to go back to some 1990s theory in England about the functions of the church from a man called Robert Warren. And he asked the question, what does church do? Well, it worships. It offers community and it acts in mission. And spirituality should beat at the heart of those three activities. Not entirely unrelated to up in out and one holy, Catholic and apostolic. But what I want to say about Robert's diagram is it was brilliant ideally. What actually is the shape of much westernized Christendom church and practice? And I suggest to you what most of us actually look like is rather different than something like this. What you will notice first is a dominant circle about worship. How do I know that? Well, I've just measured the investment of money, time, and personnel in buildings, in programs, and professional staff to run them all. That's actually where the money is being spent. And all too often, the community who meet in this building, frankly, are somewhat dysfunctional and unattractive. As one wag once said, the main reason others aren't in church is because we are. Now, thirdly, in practice, mission, frankly, is a weird thing, which either happens overseas, or it's done by enthusiasts who, thank God, are not people like us. Now, to try to make such a beast mission-minded, let alone mission-centered or mission-shaped, is profoundly difficult. And so attempts to change it very often turn out only to be a kind of nervous, temporary foray out of the fold, in order to invite or cajole a few weak-minded other people to come and worship with us in our own way, thank you. Now, I appreciate that's a bit of a cartoon, but of course the point of cartoons is that they have sufficient truth to be both amusing and pertinent. If you contrast this situation with the very varied mission field we now face, how do the elements of a mission field and being church connect? That's a diagram for mission-shaped church, and it talks about fringe, the open de-churched, the closed de-churched, and the non-churched. What I want to do is then put them into a matrix, and in one sense, this next slide summarizes much of what I've come to think over the last 10 years. There's the matrix. And there's that group of people. Let me comment a little bit more about them. Very different groups in society, reading from your left to right. There are our members, or the fringe. Our members, of course, are our people. The fringe are people who are willing to explore being our people. The de-churched used to be our people. And they divide into those who might come back if invited properly and those who are determined not to come back, however they are invited. And then there are the non-churched who have never been our people. And as I travel various parts of the westernised world, from New Zealand, say, to Toronto, in terms of south, north, east, west, I do recognise that the proportions of those four groups are different depending on the national history. What, however, is common to all of those places I visited are two features. One is that the percentage of the non-churched is growing, and it is larger the younger the section of society you take. And for both reasons, the non-churched is the major mission field of our future. So I've simply put them in a table to ask a question. How do you connect with the different groups? It may be helpful also to look at those groups, or to look at groups by context. Some of the fringe undoubtedly live as though Christendom is alive and well. That tends to be older people, and it tends to be more rural. But increasingly, there are groups of people who are post-Christian and anti-Christian, and also the children of both of those groups are starting almost to become pre-Christian. Now, if you look at the screen quite carefully, I'm just going to put up some arrows to show connections and differences. And all I want you to notice at this stage is I am not saying to you that the openly churched and the pre-Christians are the same group. I've simply put them in the same column because they share a similarity I'm going to explore with you a bit later. How then do you start with each of these very different groups, or almost tribes? Well, those fringe people on this side of the table are still in Christendom mode. They may well be helped by more accessible worship, which is attractive to them, and with a quality of welcome, particularly in an English context, we'd say is not over the top. They may well even come to traditional worship if it has quality, and indeed there are bits of evidence to suggest that continues to be true. Now, with the open de-churched, one more column this way, and the pre-Christians, the latter, because they don't have so much baggage, may well be open to certain forms of process evangelism. Now, Alpha is perhaps the best-known example, but please don't hear me saying it's the only way to do it. That's not true. Such groups may well enjoy the chance to explore, to put their questions, to observe what Christians actually do in order to relate to God. However, if you offer worship to the non-churched, they will yawn and make excuses. If you dive in with evangelism, they will simply run away. In England, the second worst social sin after intolerance is evangelism, because it is seen as imposing your views on other people. Notice the work of my finger. So you can't do worship, you can't do evangelism with the non-churched. What is left in the Christian locker? Well, it turns out to be living out community. Now, that will probably mean helping other people build, rebuild their community, as well as living out a quality of attractive community among them. I would want to say to you that has been one of our principal discoveries of the last decade. And you can put it this way. Unless communally our lives pose questions, the answers that we may want to give simply cannot be heard. So what about the de-churched who are hurt and angry? Well, the only thing I know is saying sorry. And it's a painful and slow start. Two other things about the table. Please would you note the colour coding. Please would you note that is not necessarily about attitudes to God, it's attitudes to the church. Please would you note, but not be afraid of, the difference is in style. The reality, sadly, is we actually like to stay in control. Maybe that's what pushes us to offer them the kind of worship, of course, they would like if they had any taste and discretion when remotely like us. But as soon as real evangelism begins, you are actually in dialogue. You are not in control. And if you are going to see communities regenerated, it will involve partnerships with those who do not share your faith. But entering those partnerships shows you are secure in who you are. And listening, well, that speaks for itself, but it requires vulnerability to be done well. So there's the table. There's one more thing about it which is absolutely vital to it. It only works in one direction. Good community appeals to all the tribes. Worship actually reaches the fewest, and it is almost incapable of doing much for any of the other groups. Evangelism does work a bit wider, but for many people it starts far too far on in the process. Community will lead to good questions. Conversations can lead to commitment. Worship, then, will nurture that commitment. So it seems to us from mission-shaped thinking and from the field study of the last decade, there is actually an inherent order in the creation of many fresh expressions of church. And it is very unlike what we have become used to. It is actually essential to start with church as community in mission. This group go bearing seeds of gospel and church. They live in such a way that others begin to be drawn to them. Strangers start to become friends. Prompted by what they see, they begin to ask questions. Why are you people like this? We see something about you that is mysterious but attractive. Can you explain it? And as the planting team thus connect with the culture, as they learn its cultural language, as they find its priorities, then the shape of the mission to that culture begins to get clearer. Only by being there does the specific shape to mission emerge. Some of our best planters went to certain places thinking, I know how to do good to this place. 3, 4, 5 years later, they were wishing they had gone with less and learnt to hear more and to discover what the mission was there, because that would have been better. It's all part, you see, of discerning what God is doing here. And with all of these things that I've tried to lay out for you this afternoon, none of them are quick. None of them are just add water. Well, as the mission begins to emerge, the precise shape of it, as the local people respond to Christ, as they begin to be discipled within the Christian community, then, only then, does truly indigenous worship slowly begin to emerge. And we have neither imposed Brother Handel or Brother Redman upon them. And it will grow out of the stories of how people find faith. And they go, wow, I want to relate to God. That's kind of worship, isn't it? It will come out of the stories of answered prayer. I was in a right mess. This happened. That's actually worship. It meshes with the local musical culture. Or what some people are finding is there are so many musical cultures, they actually don't do music at all, because it is culturally one of the most divisive things in a plural society. It will emerge out of people's local creative gifts. It will actually come out of what is there, not be imposed on what is there. And within it, I suggest what would be helpful as characteristic of that worship is that it continues to feed the life, the gifting, the calling, the aspirations of this growing community. If I was going to use monastic language, I would say The worship must so be encultured and designed that it nurtures the charism of the community. Would you please note the order? Public worship does not come first. Indeed, it cannot. It must be grown as the community in mission cooperates with God in evolving a mission-shaped church. Let's take another practical example.
When the Methodist Church effectively withdrew from the central area of Liverpool, Barbara Glasson was asked to try something new. She spent a year walking the streets and meeting people, and out of that came Somewhere Else.
It all started 6 years ago when I was sent as the Methodist minister to Liverpool without a church and without a congregation. So I walked the streets, I talked with people, and together we made bread. And from that process, this community has happened. There was a large Methodist central hall two streets over from here, which had had in its day a big congregation and lots of activities, lots of good work going on. But people have moved away from the city centre, and with that the congregation dwindled. So the decision was made about 12 years ago to close that building, which felt like a withdrawal from the city and a death of a church. And now people are moving back into the city centre. So there's a new residential community, as well as the work community, and also people that live on the streets. So Liverpool has got a new heart. And the question was, how can we be here ahead of that happening rather than always following a trend? How can we be ahead of a trend and be present for people as they arrive? Which is a really prophetic move on the part of the Methodist Church to want to be there for people in advance of their need. Bread making is more than just making something good to eat, although the bread's fantastic. But it's also about being able to stand round a table side by side with somebody. And what happens is that the smell of the bread and the process of making bread helps people to tell their story. Very quickly people share who they are and what their life experience is in a very easy and gentle way. And as the bread is made, so the stories unfold. And the amazing thing that has come from this experience, from this simple process of making bread and being with people, that a community has wanted to pray, has wanted to read the scriptures, wanted to explore faith, and also to worship, not just at the bread on the bread days, but also on Sundays. I've worshipped now twice a month on a Sunday.
I slept under a bush for 2 weeks and then started selling a big issue outside of the church in Bold Street where we are now. And since then, I've been here Tuesdays and Thursdays the last 2 years, helping out as much as I can. And I said that this is not a church, this is a house of God. I was confirmed in 1969 by the Bishop of Lichfield, because I went to a Church of England school when I was a kiddie. But like, as I've grown older, I haven't bothered with it. But this, to me, is a very special place, and I love it very much. I could swap it for the world.
This place doesn't exclude people. You know, it's very inclusive and welcoming, and other churches may not be as inclusive as that.
I'd like to light three candles. The first one is for...
When we get to a point where it's quiet for us, we'll go into a quieter space. Just take some time to reflect and to listen to the city around us, to listen to our own thoughts, listen to what God's saying to us and to our community. And... We invite anybody who chooses to come through. If you don't want to, that's fine. But anybody who chooses can come and say their prayers and light a candle for somebody that's on their mind. And that's a special time in our day when we can have that rhythm of coming and going and being busy and being quiet. I think with all fresh expressions of church, it's really important to stay connected somewhere, because it's very easy to lose the plot, to be isolated, or to be dangerous. And we can have a bright idea that actually harms people, and we do check each other out. But even so, there's always the question of, is this authentic, is this biblical, is this wholesome? And we have people around that we trust and will critique what we do and help us to be critical, self-critical. of what we're doing. And I think the thing that I would encourage everybody to do in thinking about Fresh Expressions is to know your place, and that is walk and listen and attend to wherever it is you are. It might be in a village or in a city like we are. You can't take too long listening to the people that are around and where God is already. I believe God's ahead of us and to be discovered, and sometimes that's despite our best plan. We are a movement here rather than stuck in a church building, or all we own here are the chairs and the tables and the ovens. We could move at any time if we needed to. And all that is true to my tradition, and it's good for me to be able to say, I see Methodism unfolding here in a new way, and I can name it and I can see it as part of my heritage.
I'd like to end with an image, an analogy, quite different from DNA. See, one of the dangers, I think, of DNA thinking is we might actually be tempted to try to do ecclesial genetic engineering. And you laugh, but actually I think it's a real danger. And it shouldn't be like that. And frankly, when it's done well, it isn't. I think we need to get back to surprise. We need to get back to the normalcy of not being in control and working as junior partners with God. So a very different image to try to leave you with. And the image I want to offer you is to think that the church and its mission is being moved on from bouncing off a springboard to something both similar and different. See, the analogy of a springboard says it's a humanly controlled risk. The diver decides how vigorously to jump off the board, what difficulty of dive to attempt. Do you note too? The dive very often is in the controlled environment of the indoor heated swimming pool. And the picture says this: let's tap into the resources that enable us to do church better, to do better what we've already been doing, for that will be quite sufficient for what we need and quite risky enough, thank you. And I'm suggesting we're being moved on beyond that. And surfboard speaks of a much higher risk in an environment the surfer cannot essentially control. The analogy is inherently far more reactive. It necessarily involves the surfer waiting for, spotting, then getting up on the wave. Now, you may know the wave is itself created by two factors. It crests because of the immediate context of the shelving seafloor beneath it and the fetch of the wind blowing across it. Now, to me, that says, read the cultural context beneath your feet and discern what the Spirit of God is doing in the mission beyond you. And when you're up, oh, then it really gets fun. And are you then in control? Well, yes and no. Because, of course, the wind may carry you somewhere where you might not have chosen. Another big difference is this. By definition, all surfboarders operate in an outside, perhaps in one sense even hostile, environment. Now, I don't deny there is similarity. Both the diver and the surfer harness power beyond themselves. Both the diver and the boarder possess great technical skills, but the diver is more in control by deciding the forces to be unleashed by the springboard, when and how to dive. The boarder is simply not in control of what occurs, only of how she or he reacts. And what is immediately clear is that the picture of the surfer conjures the greater sense of adventure and freedom and wildness. And I suggest to you that the paradigm of the springboard, of better ways back to existing church, is simply being overtaken. And in surfing, a more uncertain but creative apostolic journey is calling to us as a way onward to hitherto unknown fresh expressions of church. Yet I want to say to you, this journey in the wild is not new. It is only the path of Donovan and Allen, of Venn and Anderson, of Ritchie and Xavier, of Aidan and Cuthbert, of Martin and Anthony, of Paul in 1 Corinthians 9 and Peter in Acts 10. At the same time, I have to say to you, this way has never been terribly welcome, because it demands a trust in the Spirit beyond obvious prudence. It makes the church bound up with mission. It forces her to surrender control of outcomes. It breaks the barriers of who may belong. It overflows messily over the boundaries of how we're organized. It even disturbs how we understand what we believe. And again, I want to say to you, it's not new. Ask St. Peter on the rooftop at Joppa. And yet I want to say to you very seriously, it is our Lord who underpins risky surfing. His patterns are utterly fascinating. John highlights Jesus living in reactive attendance to the waves of what the Father is doing. Luke portrays his surprising, outrageous acceptance of the outsider. Mark shows the immediacy of his response, not a measured tread. Jesus never even heard of a 5-year plan. Matthew stresses his cultural particularity. Paul in Philippians tells us the cost of it. Gethsemane and Golgotha show us Jesus carried to where he did not wish to go. Well, surfing in mission might sound glorious. The death and the resurrection of the church as we have known her might well be the consequence. And I pray that the church of our day, if you're in the Catholic tradition, you will understand this, can tolerate its own Holy Saturday for long enough. Or in a wider biblical tradition, whether it can endure its period of exile long enough to sow seeds of Jesus-centered communities so that, who knows when, it may be raised different for tomorrow in the ongoing mission of God. Because I'm beginning to guess that nothing else is going to do. What would be dreadful, not least because it is possible, is if the church got only half the point. The church is very capable of saying something like, "Oh yes, I see that waves are rather good and they could be rather fun. Why don't we install a wave machine in our swimming pools? We could also start courses on responsible, safe indoor surfing. Why don't we stay in control? Let's change the game, but we will use the new language to show we've got it." To which I say, no! Please not. Please, can we do the real thing? Let's go with listening to the Spirit of God already blowing across the face of our culture. Let's listen. Let's wait. Let's watch. Let's catch the waves and fall off and try it again of what God is already doing. Let's risk that we will sometimes fall off and sometimes we are going to get the ride of our lives. I think that's something of what we meant when we wrote mission shaped church. We funnily enough thought that only by being caught up in a particular mission could you find out what church was going to be as a result. We did not mean church shaped mission. And don't think that will do. That is simply back to the springboard. So let's do it. And even if we may look like artists, the reality is we are only junior partners. We do not make the wind, the seabed, or the resultant wave. We've just cooperated with what we've spotted. Let's do the surfing even if we aren't very good at it. Even if we cannot see where it might take us, we cannot yet see what waves are going to come along and who they might carry us to be among. If Acts is reliable, we will probably start in our Jerusalems, and the tendency is God will take us beyond our Judeas into some scary Samarias and some woe ends of the earth.